religion, disability, and familiar status. You can't even ask questions about those terms without appearing discriminatory, so don't do it. Additionally, protected statuses, such as being Section 8, marital status, and political affiliation, may also be protected, depending on the state you live in. Be sure to check with your state's fair housing laws. Showing the property to tenants. Showing units can be difficult because much of the time, tenants with whom you have arranged a meeting will simply not show up. To combat this, I use one of two techniques. Number one, I give them the address to drive by first and tell them to call me back if they are interested in seeing the inside. This eliminates the people who lose interest because of location. Number two, I try to batch all the showings within one time frame. I will tell all callers that I will be at the house from 5 to 5:30 on Friday afternoon, for example, if they want to see it. They should show up then. Having multiple tenants look at a property at the same time can be a little awkward, but it creates a sense of competition and scarcity, which allows for more applications. It is also a good idea to include the criteria and application process with the application. This allows a prospective tenant to easily understand how the process works and gives you yet another way to pre-screen for duds. The application process. Give an application to every single person who is interested, even if you are not interested in them. This is just another measure to ensure you will not be charged with discrimination. Encourage them to fill it out there, though the applicant will usually want to fill it out later and drop it off or mail it to you. I try to discourage this because it just adds a lot of time, but sometimes a tenant will want to think about it, so have a plan in place to deal with this. The rental application. An ideal rental application should have space for the tenant to fill in the following items for all adult applicants at minimum. Name, date of birth, social security number, phone number and cell phone number, alternate phone number, previous address, current employer, past employer, emergency contact information, release of information statement, signature, and application fee. You can get a sample application that I use at www.biggerpockets.com/landlordbookbonus. Always, I repeat, always take an application fee with the application. Don't even bother processing any part of the application unless the tenant has paid the application fee. The amount you charge must be reasonable and reflect the actual cost of you running the application, plus reasonable compensation for your time doing so. I recommend finding out what the local property management companies charge and charging a similar amount. Currently, I charge $35 per adult. Be sure to check with your state law and make sure there are no laws dictating how much you can charge. Immediate disqualifiers. When you receive an application from a tenant with the application fee, look the document over and check the important things before ordering the official background check. The obvious things are those things you read to the tenant over the phone, which I covered earlier. If you can quickly see that the rent for the house is $1,000 a month and the applicant only makes $1,800 per month in gross income, they clearly did not pass the income qualifications. Sometimes this is because of a writing error or income they forgot to include, so be sure to clarify with them before completely rejecting the applicant. Chances are, however, that the tenant simply doesn't qualify and was hoping you wouldn't notice. If you did a thorough job of explaining the criteria over the phone with the applicant and they still applied and didn't qualify, it's up to you if you want to return the application fee. However, don't bother running the background check or credit check if you already know they're disqualified because of one of the obvious criteria. I'll cover more about how to disqualify someone in just a moment. Screening tenants. Have you heard the story about the tenant who deliberately threw maggots down the stairs to the tenant below? Or about the tenant who moved 15 children into an 800-square-foot house? I did not make these stories up for your entertainment. They're actually true stories from actual Bigger Pockets members and are just a tiny sample of what a real estate investor must go through sometimes to be a landlord. However, your experience doesn't have to be like these if you have a great tenant. Screening is how you separate the good from the bad, or at least try to. Screening is about digging into an applicant's background and discovering who they really are outside of the application. After all, an application can only tell you so much, and data can be easily manipulated or falsified. Screening your tenant means looking into the information they provided, as well as analyzing outside information you can discover, and coming to a reasonable assumption regarding the kind of tenant they will be. I say reasonable assumption because there are no surefire ways of knowing the future quality of a tenant. As landlords, our job is to simply screen effectively and choose the best possible applicant for the property. Deciding what kind of background or credit history you'll allow depends largely on your location and the strength of your market. If you have a lot of applicants to choose from, you can be a bit more picky and only accept the most qualified tenant. However, if you are struggling to get applicants, you may need to lower your standards slightly, and I mean slightly, to move someone in. For me, I hold the person's rental history and income in a lot higher regard than I do their credit, because I live in a lower income area where the vast majority of prospective tenants have terrible credit. Your area might be different, so if possible, talk to other landlords or ask for advice on the Bigger Pockets forums. The things I look closely at on the background and credit checks are these: prior felonies, prior evictions filed, prior evictions carried out, bankruptcies, judgments, and other criminal issues or a bad financial history. I make it a policy to never rent to a person with an eviction on their record or a recent felony within 7 years. Yes, people do change, but personally, I don't find the risk worth taking. I'll leave that risk to other landlords, and then probably buy their property after they're foreclosed on and lose it all. Verifying income and rental history. People often lie, especially when they want to get into a new rental and cannot qualify. As a result, verifying everything that the tenant writes on their application is vitally important. As I explained earlier, your application should include a release of information signature from your prospective tenant that allows you to properly check their claims. Begin with their job. The application should include the name and phone number of their current employer, so call to speak with the company's manager, owner, or human resource manager. Many times, you'll be required to fax over the release of information signature. The important questions to ask are these: how much do they currently make? How long have they worked there? Is this job considered temporary? Next, call their previous landlords. Don't simply call their current landlord, because many landlords will lie or embellish the truth in an effort to get rid of a bad tenant. Instead, call all their previous landlords for at least the past 5 years. Be sure to conduct a background check and credit check to see if any other addresses appear that might indicate they conveniently forgot to list their landlord they rented from. When talking with previous landlords, you might want to consider asking the following questions: how long did the tenant rent from you? What was their monthly rent? Did the tenant give proper notice when vacating? Did the tenant receive their security deposit back? Would you rent to this tenant again? Accepting or denying an applicant. After doing a background check and verifying that the information listed on a potential tenant's application is correct, you will have a good idea of whether or not the tenant is worthy of your rental property. Sometimes, you will receive applications from multiple parties who all qualify. To avoid discrimination complaints, I recommend processing applications on a first-come, first-served basis, processing applications until you discover the tenant does not qualify and moving on to the next. Of course, you can choose to rent to the most qualified individual, but be sure that you can clearly demonstrate what non-discriminatory thing made one better than the other. When you deny an applicant, clearly documenting your reasons for doing so is important to avoid discrimination complaints. Always inform the tenant with a written notice. I always send a letter to the tenant stating that they did not meet the minimum requirement for tenancy and for such and such reason. Be sure to keep a copy of all records pertaining to the prospective tenant so you can back up your reason for denying them in the future, should you need to. When you find an applicant who meets all your requirements, you can verbally let them know that they are approved. However, your job is not yet finished. Many times, a good applicant will be approved, but will find another place to rent, leaving you wondering what happened to them. Therefore, it is important to require a deposit to hold the vacant property. This deposit is non-refundable and should be due within 24 hours of the tenant being accepted. Simply let the approved applicant know that you cannot hold the property indefinitely, so if they want to guarantee their position, they must pay the deposit within 24 hours. Some landlords actually require that this deposit be paid when the application is filled out, and the landlord simply returns the deposit if the tenant doesn't qualify. I don't personally use this technique, but it may work for your location if there are a lot of qualified applicants trying to rent your property. This deposit will become the tenant's security deposit, which I will get to later. So it's not an unexpected or extra cost for the applicant. When you collect this deposit, be sure to sign two copies of a deposit to hold agreement that states what the deposit is for and what the terms are. Essentially, this document would declare that the applicant has until a certain, clearly specified date to sign a lease agreement. If an agreement is not signed by that date, the deposit is forfeited to the landlord. Both you and the prospective tenant will receive a copy of this agreement, which will serve as a receipt for the applicant. I try to schedule the lease signing for as soon as possible to minimize the amount of time the property is left vacant and costing me money. Typically, I will not hold it longer than 2 weeks unless I absolutely love the tenant and don't want to lose them. This is up to you and your discretion. To sign a rental lease with your tenant, you will need to have, of course, a lease. You can get a state-specific lease agreement from a number of sources, like easylandlordsforms.com, uslegalforms.com, a local paper supply company such as Staples or Office Depot, or from your attorney. Don't simply download a free lease off the internet. Each state has different rules and laws that govern the landlord-tenant policies in that state, so chances are that the lease you found for free online may not be legally binding for you. Don't skimp on the quality of your lease. One recommendation I do have is if you decide to use a lease you found online or in a book, take it to a local attorney to have them review it and make sure it's state-specific for you. Before getting your lease agreement, however, you need to decide whether you want a month-to-month rental agreement, a one-year lease, or something in between. Most landlords choose a one-year lease in an effort to keep their tenants in the home as long as possible and to minimize turnover. Others choose to offer only month-to-month leases to maintain the ability to quickly and easily remove a tenant if things don't work out. Still others choose a 6 or 9 month lease, which is often helpful in ensuring that a lease doesn't end during the holiday months of November through January, when vacancies are the most difficult to fill. This comes down to a personal choice, but no matter which lease term you choose, be sure to obtain the correct lease agreement form. Although lease agreements generally vary in length and content, most contain the following information: the name of the tenant, the address of the rental property, the lease term length, the rental amount, the security deposit amount, the late fee description, the move-in condition report, and provisions for or against pets, utilities, smoking, and the like. You may also need to provide certain state and federal documents with your lease, depending on when your home was built and your state laws. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency requires that you give your tenant a pamphlet called Protecting Your Family from Lead in the Home, if your property was built before 1978. Check with your local attorney for other state-specific forms you may be required to provide. Signing a lease agreement. Schedule a time for the tenant to meet with you at the property, or as Chris Clothier recently mentioned on an episode of the Bigger Pockets podcast, sign all the papers at your attorney's office. Of course, showing professionalism and the seriousness of what they're signing. Don't sign at a coffee shop or via mail or fax. Actually meet at the property on the day they'll be moving in, or drive over from the attorney's office after signing. I find it helpful to go through the lease ahead of time and mark all the signature or initial areas with a post-it note or a highlighter so nothing is forgotten or missed. When you meet with the tenant, walk them through each provision in the lease step by step and sign with a blue pen as you go. This may be time-consuming, but it will help protect you when the tenant says, "Well, I didn't know that," months down the road. You may consider having the tenant initial next to important items as well, such as a no pet policy. It is really easy for a tenant to later forget details, so having them initial such things is helpful in jogging their memory later on. Accepting the rent. During the lease signing, when you get to the part that says how much the monthly rent is, this is a good time to collect the money for the first month's rent. You should have already received the tenant's security deposit in the form of the deposit to hold when they were approved. So typically, this is when you would collect the first month's rent. If a tenant moves in the middle of the month, I don't typically prorate the amount they pay for that first month. Instead, I prorate the second month to match the first. In other words, every tenant pays a full month's rent when they move in, but when the time comes to pay the rent on the first of the following month, they'll only pay for the amount of days they lived in the home the first month. For example, if the rent is $1,200 a month and they move in on January 10th, they'll pay the full $1,200 for rent when they move in, but only $800 on February 1st. One final note on the rent. Only accept rent in certified funds, such as a money order or a cashier's check. Don't take cash and don't accept personal checks, especially for the first month's rent. You do not want to move a tenant in and find out weeks later that the check was bad, forcing you to evict. Been there, done that. This is a wise policy to have all around in your relationships with your tenants. Certified funds only. As for rent payments in the future, I recommend not picking up the rent in person because this will only train your tenant to expect you each month. For my rentals, I used to mail monthly statements to the tenant and they mailed their certified funds to my post office box. However, over time, I grew tired of the "my check is lost in the mail" story, so I switched over to giving tenants three different options. First, Pay Near Me or PayLease.com. These similar services allow tenants without bank accounts to pay at local businesses like 7-Eleven or Walmart. Currently, the tenant must pay a small fee, $4, for the service, but it's generally free or low cost to the landlord. Dwolla. Similar to PayPal, tenants can use Dwolla.com to pay rent directly from their checking account for free. This was a little bit cumbersome to get set up, but once I got it going, the process works pretty great. The only trouble I've had is that some banks don't work well with Dwolla, usually small community banks, so prepare for such an instance. And third, Intuit Payment Network. Intuit, the company behind TurboTax and QuickBooks, offers a payment solution that is extremely easy to use and that allows tenants to pay their rent directly from their checking account. Currently, payments are just 50 cents each, and we use this when the tenant's bank account doesn't work with Dwolla. Many landlords have different techniques for collecting rent, so be sure to check out the BiggerPockets forums for more suggestions and ideas from other experienced property owners. Ultimately, you may change or adapt your style as you learn more and grow, or as technology advances. The Move-In Condition Report. By this time, the rent and security deposit have been paid and the lease has been signed. It's now important to do one final thing before handing over the keys: the Move-In Condition Report. The move-in condition report is simply a paper that the tenant will sign that documents in detail the condition of the property. Allow the tenant to take some time walking through the property and inspecting it, perhaps even taking notes on the condition of each room. If there is a hole in the door, document it. If there's a light switch that doesn't work, document it. If there's a stain in the carpet, document it. The move-in condition report is designed to protect both your interests and the interests of the tenant when the time comes for the tenant to move out. As much as you think you'll remember every detail of the home, trust me, you won't. By documenting everything and having a tenant sign off on that documentation, the tenant cannot come back to you later and say, "Oh, that giant hole in the wall, that was there when I moved in." For the same reason, I also recommend taking photos or a video of the property before handing over keys. This will be further evidence in the future when a tenant moves out. In many states, a landlord cannot deduct any charges from the security deposit if a move-in condition report was not filled out when the tenant moved in. So don't make that mistake. Document, document, document. Handing over the keys. When the tenant has filled out the entire lease agreement, both parties have signed it, the move-in condition report has been signed, and the rent has been paid, you can now hand over keys to the tenant and allow them possession. Although the tenant may ask to do so, never let a tenant move things into a property before signing the lease and paying the rent. The consequence for failing to do this could be disastrous. The process for moving a tenant into a property may seem overwhelming at first, but soon the process will be second nature to you. I encourage you to take this application time seriously because it will set a standard for how your tenant relationship will go for the next several years. By showing you are professional at every step, your tenant will respect you and follow your rules because you are the authority. This is the first step in training your tenant, whereby you set the ground rules at the beginning of your relationship and ensure they are aware you're not the kind of landlord they can walk all over. Bookkeeping and taxes. Perhaps the least sexy part of being a real estate investor is keeping track of the bookkeeping. Yes, I know you got into real estate to free yourself from bureaucracy, paperwork, TPS reports, and having a job. I know you want to just sit back and wait for the checks to come in. However, if you don't do accurate accounting within your business, you could lose everything and, maybe worse, end up in jail. Besides, for a landlord, bookkeeping is designed to help you pay less taxes. That's right, less taxes. The better job you do at bookkeeping, the lower taxes you'll likely pay. Bookkeeping is a practice of knowing where every dollar comes from and where it goes. Really, it's that simple. The way you track that, however, is where things can get a little complicated. Numerous tools are available out there to help you track your income and expenses. First, spreadsheets. A good spreadsheet software like Microsoft Excel or a free Google Sheets can help you keep an accurate record of the money that goes in and out of your business. Although it generally must be designed from the ground up, so you'll need at least a basic understanding of how accounting for landlord works. The downside of the spreadsheet model is that there is no automatic bank reconciliation, and you can't take the data and create numerous different reports like you might be able to with some other methods. However, when you are just getting started, using a basic spreadsheet might be enough for you. If so, I find it best to divide your spreadsheet into sections that correspond with the IRS categories for income and expenses, as seen in figure 14 at biggerpockets.com/rentalbookfigures. QuickBooks. Many landlords choose to use professional accounting software such as QuickBooks to record everything. QuickBooks can be a bit overwhelming to learn and may feel like you are swatting a fly with a cannon, but once you learn the system, keeping track of income and expenses becomes increasingly easy, as does tax time. CPAs love landlords who use QuickBooks correctly. QuickBooks, however, is not designed specifically for landlords and rental properties, so it takes some heavy configuration to get it set up properly for you and your rental business. If you are unfamiliar with how to use QuickBooks, I recommend taking an online course to learn the software. There are several good training programs specifically designed to teach landlords how to use QuickBooks for their business, such as mylandlordsbookkeeper.wordpress.com and www.landlordaccounting.com. Rental property software. A third option used by landlords to track their income and expenses is online rental property software like Vertical Rent, Buildium, or Appfolio. These products are designed to help you manage your property, keeping track of tenants, leases, reminders, repairs, etc., but also contain basic accounting features. These programs let you prepare and print numerous reports, such as a rent roll or end-of-year tax statement. Most of these programs charge a monthly fee to manage your property, so be sure to shop around to determine which would work best for you and your portfolio. For example, Buildium and Vertical Rent are designed a little more for the smaller investor, while Appfolio is designed for investors with dozens or hundreds of units. Bookkeeper. Finally, you may want to consider outsourcing your entire bookkeeping operation to someone professionally trained to do it. Although you will still need to accurately track receipts and income, you can hire a professional bookkeeper to keep it all in order, enter it into QuickBooks or another program, and get the paperwork ready for tax season. There are bookkeepers in nearly every town, but it would be best to find one with experience dealing with rental properties for other landlords or themselves. Bookkeeping can be stressful and annoying for any landlord, but the more professional your bookkeeping is throughout the year, the easier tax season will be. In addition, the more expenses you accurately record, the less money you'll pay come tax season. So focus on doing your bookkeeping correctly from the start and hire a professional if you don't want to do it yourself. Paying taxes. The IRS considers the cash flow you receive on your real estate income. Therefore, you must pay taxes on the money. The good news, however, is that the current IRS code is very generous to real estate investors, allowing you to deduct nearly all your expenses and even some unrealized expenses, namely depreciation. This can help offset your cash flow and make your actual tax bill zero, if not less. The method for doing your taxes is a little beyond the scope of this book, but I'll leave you with this. The more properties you have, the more difficult and complicated your taxes will be. I could no longer do my taxes even if I wanted to. The upside, however, is that when you are at the higher levels of this game, a good CPA should be able to help you save up more money than they cost you. Wrapping it up. Preparation is key to the success of any venture, and landlording is no different. The topics I covered in this chapter may feel overwhelming, but trust me, the way you set up your landlording business from the beginning will define how your landlording business operates in the end. From finding the perfect tenant to setting up the books, the importance of preparation cannot be overstated. You've done so much great work so far. Now is not the time to back over and kill the cat, to use an example from earlier. So take special care during this part of your business development to ensure that the empire you've built stays strong. No matter how well you set up and prepare your rental property, you're going to have problems. Things will break, people lie, and conflicts will arise. In the next chapter, I'm going to deal exclusively with those issues, how to handle problems with your rental property investing, because trust me, you're going to have them. Chapter 18, Managing Your Rentals, Part 2. The tree that never had to fight for sun and sky and air and light, but stood out in the open plain and always got its share of rain, never became a forest king, but lived and died a scrubby thing. Douglas Malik, Good Timber. Many years ago, researchers in Illinois planted a number of small trees inside a greenhouse, dividing the trees into three groups. Trees in the first group were supported firmly by a wooden stake to help them grow tall and straight. Those in the second group were not staked at all, but left to grow free. Trees in the third group, as in the second, were not staked, but manually shaken back and forth for several minutes every day. After several months, the researchers looked at the three groups of trees and saw the inevitable. The staked trees in the first group were tall, but weak. The trees in the second group were of medium height, but also fairly weak. The trees in the third group, which had been shaken daily, had developed strong roots and a thick trunk that would help them grow tall and strong, though perhaps a bit more slowly than the other two groups. The analogy should not be lost on you. Strength comes from adversity, as you've no doubt found in other areas of your life. Problems will arise, and how you deal with them is what defines your future. In this chapter, I will explore the many different problems you will encounter in your rental property business, specifically dealing with managing tenants. Problems will occur in your business, but how you overcome those difficulties will ultimately lead to your long-term success. Let's begin by talking about the most common problem you'll encounter, maintenance and repairs. Maintenance and repairs. As much as I wish rental properties stayed in tip-top shape forever, that is just not the case. One of your most important jobs as a landlord is to maintain the property and fix things when they break. Although this can be expensive and stressful, if you follow the analysis part of this book, you'll have money set aside to handle those issues. If not, you'll need to come up with the cost from your own pocket. But either way, the repair must be fixed. The 10 most common repairs you'll encounter. The most common repair requests we get from tenants are the following. Number 1, the fridge, stove, dishwasher not working. Appliances have a lot of moving parts and therefore tend to break down fairly often. Although some issues can be fixed by the landlord themselves, like replacing a burned out light bulb, installing a new heating element, whatever, many issues will require a qualified appliance repair person. Unless a new appliance is needed, the typical cost to fix this sort of issue is between $50 and $100 an hour, and most repairs can be handled in under an hour. If you do need a new appliance, consider buying a used one. Used appliance stores exist in almost every town, and especially in the cases of stoves, can provide units that are just as good as new. Although, I never buy a used dishwasher. Number 2, water leak in the ceiling or under windows. Water may be required for the human body to survive, but it is deadly to a rental property. If left unchecked, water can destroy wood, drywall, flooring, and virtually every other surface of your property. Even in small amounts, moisture can cause mold to grow, which can be expensive to remediate if it gets out of control. When your tenant reports a water problem, make this your number one concern. Hire a qualified contractor to check the problem out and fix it immediately. When you're dealing with the water leak, don't hire the cheapest guy, hire the best. It's also a good idea to know whether your property has water supply lines in the ceiling, so if there's a leak, you can call a plumber instead of a roofing contractor. Number 3, water leak under the sink. A water leak under a kitchen or bathroom sink can have one or two causes. The supply line, or the pipe that brings water to the sink, both hot and cold, or the drain that takes the water from the sink and sends it out to the sewer. I estimate that 90% of the water leaks are caused by the drain pipe not fitting together correctly. This is a fairly easy thing for you to learn how to fix. Just watch some YouTube videos to find out how, or hire a plumber, which should cost approximately $100. Number 4, water drip from faucets. A slow drip from a sink or bathroom can end up costing you hundreds of dollars per year. So if you have a slow drip, get it fixed right away. In most cases, the problem can be solved with a 50-cent rubber washer and about an hour of work by a plumber or yourself. However, occasionally the entire faucet will need to be replaced. If this is the case, don't buy the $18 faucet that's mostly plastic. You'll just be tearing it out again next summer and replacing it once again. And again. And again. Number 5, no hot water. If the tenant loses their hot water, it's likely a problem with the hot water heater. If they need a new hot water heater, you'll spend approximately $600 for a plumber to replace it. However, it might just be the heating element inside the heater, in which case you can either replace it yourself for about $20 and a couple hours of work, or hire a plumber for a couple $100 to do it for you. Number 6, bugs or rodents. Dealing with pests can be one of the most annoying jobs for a landlord because much of the time, it is the tenant's own fault that they are dirty. Bugs and rodents like crumbs, so tenants with clean houses rarely have a problem. That said, it's still your responsibility to make sure that any infestation is well taken care of. We tackle this issue on two fronts. First, educating the tenant, and second, hiring a pest specialist to deal with the issue, which typically costs a few hundred dollars. Also, be sure to seal up any holes, no matter how small, that bugs or rodents could use to get into the property. Many landlords include in their lease that pest control is the tenant's responsibility after a certain number of weeks. This way, the landlord can say that it was definitely not the property's problem, but it must be the tenant's. I find this works okay in single-family houses, but in multifamily units, it can be impossible to find out where the bugs originated from because they travel through walls pretty easily. Number 7, garbage disposals. These technological wonders may be great for grinding up food in your house, but they are a constant thorn in the side of landlords. They break all the time. I believe this is mostly because tenants put things down them that never belong in the garbage disposal. I didn't know I wasn't supposed to put a whole chicken down there. For this reason, I try to remove garbage disposals from my properties whenever possible. However, if your garbage disposal breaks while a tenant is in there and you need to fix it, there are generally two things that could be wrong. First, it might just be stuck and need an Allen wrench to unstick it. Or the motor might be burned out, in which case you'll need a new disposal, which might run a couple $100, including installation by a handyman. Number 8, toilet water leaks. Toilets may be made of long-lasting porcelain, but the tank parts are generally cheap pieces of plastic that break all the time. If a toilet is running, so water can be heard going through it 24/7, or the tank refills with water on its own every so often, it's most likely a problem with the flapper. Typically, these kind of problems can be fixed with less than $20 in parts and an hour of labor by a plumber, handyman, or you. Number 9, a clogged toilet. If your tenant clogs the toilet, this is not your responsibility. Problems that are caused by the tenant are the tenant's responsibility, so inform them that they need to call a plumber to deal with the issue. Or call a plumber yourself and bill the tenant for the cost. However, if the drain seems to be clogged in the bathroom or bathtub sink as well, this is a good indication that the problem may lie with your drain pipe, such as a collapsed pipe or a tree root that has grown through it. I once had a tenant who flushed huge rocks down the toilet. This caused a major problem for me and resulted in a hefty plumber's bill. Number 10, furnace repairs. Heat is vital, so a furnace repair, especially during the winter, is one of the most important repairs on the list. If a furnace goes out, it can be something as simple as a pilot light going out or as complicated as a gas leak. When your tenant calls, get a furnace repair specialist out to the property immediately. Also, many furnace problems would have never happened had the furnace filter been replaced often, so be sure your tenant knows how and when to do this, and check up on them. You'll likely encounter more problems than I've listed here while owning rental properties, but these 10 issues will likely represent 99% of the issues you'll face. None of them, by themselves, are expensive to fix. However, if left untreated, each of these can end up costing you thousands or even tens of thousands of dollars in damage. Treat each of these items with care and address them immediately. Your tenant and your wallet will thank you. Landlord versus tenant responsibilities. Not all repairs are the responsibility of the landlord. Your job is to provide a safe, habitable property that is up to code. For example, unless your local jurisdiction specifically requires it, you do not have to provide a new paint if a tenant's child draws all over the walls. You don't need to fix a piece of torn carpet if the tenant tears it. You don't need to provide new blinds because the tenant doesn't like the color. Unless your lease or local laws require you to fix those items, doing so is kind of up to you. However, items such as smoke detectors, heat, appliances, plumbing, these are your responsibilities to maintain. I recommend that you get a copy of your state's landlord-tenant laws and read them thoroughly to understand what is and is not required in your area. Furthermore, repairs that are needed because the tenant broke something can be made the responsibility of the tenant. For example, if a tenant breaks a window while moving some furniture, you are not responsible for the cost. However, unless you want your window covered with cardboard and duct tape for the next 6 months, you may want to hire the contractor to fix the issue and bill the tenant. I highly recommend that. While the landlord definitely has certain responsibilities with regard to the condition of the property, so does the tenant. It is the tenant's responsibility to report problems when they occur, and if they don't, the cost of fixing those issues could be placed on the tenant, depending on your state's laws, of course. Your tenant also must keep the property reasonably clean and safe to make sure they don't misuse the systems in the property, such as by overloading electrical outlets or flushing large objects down a toilet. annual preventative maintenance. In addition to fixing problems when they happen, there is another category of repair that, as a landlord, you'll need to make sure gets done. Preventative maintenance. In other words, these are the tasks that need to be accomplished on a regular basis, usually annually, whether or not anything is broken. They are preventative measures, not necessarily repairs. Accomplishing these projects annually will keep your property's future repair needs to a minimum and allow your property to run like a well-oiled machine. It will help you save money over time because you'll spot problems before they become an issue. I recommend giving the following list to your handyman once a year for each unit you own. Keep in mind, this list is just a sample of some of the ongoing property maintenance you may need to do. Not all will apply to your property, and your property may have additional concerns. But this is a good place to start. Interior. Change the furnace filters, probably more than once a year. Vacuum dust from the fridge coils. Replace smoke detector batteries. Check to make sure carbon monoxide detectors are installed and working. Sweep the fireplace. Ensure that lint from the dryer vent has a clear path to the outside. Flush the hot water heater. Check expiration date on fire extinguisher. Repair any broken grout or caulk in the bathroom. Tighten any handles, knobs, racks, etc. Remove the shower head and clean the sediment. Check weather stripping on all doors and windows and repair as needed. Exterior. Clean gutters and remove all the leaves and junk from inside them. Check the siding and roofing for visible signs of problems. Check the sump pump and make sure it's still operational. Test the garage door opener, including the auto reverse function. Check window screens and repair as necessary. Look for signs of termites and other bugs. Check trees for power line interference. Re-caulk any doors or windows as needed. Trim up the landscaping. Inspect the crawl space. Look for bugs and water leaks. Touch up peeling or damaged paint. Fertilize the lawn. Close off any openings to the crawl space. Check water valves in both the spring and fall. Wash the exterior with a garden hose and mildew cleaner. By executing this preventative maintenance checklist each year, you'll be able to catch problems before they become expensive fixes, while, at the same time, keeping your property looking great. Plus, your tenant will appreciate your dedication in helping their home look and operate the best. It is a true win-win. Dealing with difficult tenants. One of the toughest parts about being a landlord is dealing with problem tenants. No one enjoys confrontation or drama, but unless you outsource your tenant interaction to a property manager, you will have to expect to handle those situations yourself. Of course, the best way to minimize drama with tenants is through proper tenant screening and allowing only the best tenants to rent from you. However, even with the highest screening standards and practices, bad tenants will make their way into your property. Therefore, the next best way to minimize bad tenants is by effectively training them. Training your tenants. Charlie is my adorable 18-month-old Yorkie, who weighs less than 10 pounds. Although he's kind of a stupid dog, every head in the room invariably turns whenever he jumps in the air, rolls over, speaks, or does any of his other special tricks. That's the fun advantages dogs have over cats, right? Their trainability. Like dogs, tenants also need to be trained. Yeah, I just said that. It may sound demeaning, but it's not. We are all trained to do certain things. We obey the speed limit, go talk on our cell phone in the movie theater, and cover our mouth when we sneeze. Properly training your tenant can make all the difference in the world between being successful in real estate and being absolutely miserable. Tenants are like pets, but with cell phones, Facebook, and lawyers. They need to be poked and prodded into submitting to the will of the landlord. But how do you train a tenant? Despite the urge, not with a big stick. Tenants are trained the same way Charlie was. Establish rules, reward good behavior, and apply punishment when the rules are broken. Therefore, the first step is establishing your rules via the lease agreement. Make sure your tenant has a copy of their lease and that it contains all the rules and regulations you want followed. Then, make sure you enforce them. Just like when a bad parent refuses to punish their kid for misbehaving and ends up with an unruly kid on their hands, when you fail to enforce a rule for your tenant, you will find yourself dealing with a selfish, spoiled, and entitled tenant. The easiest way of punishing tenants is through fees, late fees, non-compliance fees, etc. Now, many landlords struggle with applying fees, especially when their tenant calls and says they can't pay the rent because so-and-so had this sickness or their vehicle broke down or they lost hours at work. However, it is not the landlord's job to be Santa. You will find that when your policy is to never budge on the rent, suddenly, all those excuses just disappear. When I first started in real estate, I tried to be nice all the time. But trying to be the nice guy screwed me over time, time, and time again. As soon as I made the decision to enforce every fee, late payments dropped from almost a dozen a month down to none. Late fees are rare now, and when they do occur, tenants don't usually call and complain. They know the rules, and they are properly trained. But even well-trained kids, pets, and people cause problems. No matter how well you screen and how well you train, you will still need to deal with the issues as they arise. In this next section, I want to discuss five of the most common problems you'll likely encounter as a landlord and share my best tips on training your tenant to abide by your rules. Number one, late rent. Late rent is not okay. You cannot allow a tenant to pay rent late on a consistent basis. I don't just say this for your benefit, but also for your tenants. If you let them pay late, you are training them that this is okay. They will pay later and later until pretty soon they are 3 months behind and you have a completely untrainable tenant. When you allow late rent, you just make the problem worse for everyone. You might think that you're being a jerk by enforcing on-time payments, but trust me, you are doing the tenant a favor. Of course, this is one of those areas of landlording that I and millions of other landlords will tell you is important, but you will still probably ignore it until you discover the truth for yourself. It's really hard to be strict, but in the end, it truly is the best scenario for everyone. When the rent is due but doesn't come in, immediately serve a notice, pay or vacate. Every state is different, but most require a notice to be served on the front door of the property that tells the tenant they have 3 to 5 days, somewhere in there depending on your state, to pay or vacate. This form will probably also list the late fees they now owe because of being late. The amount of the late fee should be defined in their lease. Don't just make one up. When the set number of days is up and they have not yet paid, it is time to get them out of there. You have a few choices. Number one, you could work out a payment plan. Number two, you could ask them to leave. Number three, you could pay them to leave, which is called cash for keys. Or number four, you could evict them. I don't ever recommend option one, working out a payment plan. Trying to work out a payment plan has never worked for me. It shows that you are soft on the rules and trains them that next time they can just work something out again. And trust me, it will happen again and again and again. I don't recommend this except in extreme cases. Option two is to simply ask them to leave. Simply talk with the tenant and let them know, hey, this is not working out. Let's just go our separate ways, okay? This rarely works, but it's worth a conversation. Maybe they feel like they're stuck between a rock and a hard place because they have a lease and they don't want to break it, but they also can't afford the rent. By letting them know that you are okay with them leaving, maybe they'll take you up on the offer. If not, I usually move quickly to option three. Option three is commonly known in the landlord space as cash for keys. It is the act of paying your tenant to vacate the property. Yes, seriously. I know this goes against everything you want to do to a tenant who is causing you so much financial pain and stress, but don't let your pride get in the way of the almighty dollar. It is just business, and paying the tenant to leave may be the cheaper and best option. An eviction can cost between $1,000 and $3,000 just for the attorney, and depending on your state, it could take several months of lost rent to get them out. When the eviction finally does go through, chances are the tenant will have trashed the unit and left a huge mess for you to have to pay to have cleaned. An eviction could easily end up costing you $5,000 or more by the end of the day. Instead, why not offer the tenant a few $100 to walk away quickly, saving their record from having an eviction on it, and getting them out of the property? Of course, if you offer them money, do so on the contingency that they leave quickly within the next day or two, and that the property be move-in ready for the next tenant. Then, don't hand over the cash until they have vacated, given you the keys, and signed a release letting you know they have moved. And you've inspected the unit to make sure it wasn't trashed. Cash for keys may damage your ego a little, but it can save you thousands of dollars and keep your stress level at a minimum. Sometimes, though, you will simply have to evict a tenant. No one likes to evict, and as I mentioned, the process can be very expensive and lengthy. You can do the eviction yourself, but I don't generally recommend it for new investors because there are so many legal steps you must take, and if you do any of them incorrectly or in the wrong order, you could be forced to start your eviction over from the beginning, costing you even more time and money. Instead, use an attorney who is well-trained in evicting tenants. After the initial notice is taped to the door, or you've given it to them in person, and after the number of days required by your state is over, call up your attorney and explain the situation. They will likely want a copy of the lease, as well as all the information about the tenant that you have. After you hand that over, you are done. You can sit back and wait for your attorney to handle the eviction. When I first began landlording, a lot of tenants paid late. Tenants would call and I'd give them a few more days. They would tell me a story about why the rent was late and I'd sympathize and waive the late fee. I worked out payment plans. And then I stopped being Mr. Nice Guy and, here's a novel concept, started actually following the rental agreement. Once the tenant knew I was serious and that there was a penalty to paying late, the late payment stopped almost completely. Late rent is fairly rare now because the tenants have been properly trained. And that is the key. Number two, neighbor conflicts. If you are buying a multifamily property, it is likely that you'll get complaints from one tenant about the other, like the following. The tenant upstairs walks too loudly. The other tenant parks in my parking spot. The tenant downstairs is having sex too loudly at 2 a.m. They keep throwing trash in my yard. I don't let their kids play near my garden gnome. Sometimes, having tenants feels a bit like running a daycare. I should know, my mom did daycare in our house for my entire childhood. Although there is no cure-all solution for this kind of drama, here are a few tips for handling it. First, let them figure it out. When I'm not renting out a unit, I let most calls go to voicemail and then call the tenant back. If it is a tenant complaining about something another tenant is doing, I will often wait a couple days to call them back, unless, of course, it's an emergency. About 90% of the time, tenant handles the situation themselves. Be direct. If one tenant is doing something that violates their rental contract, be direct and firm with them. In most states, there is a notice to comply form you can deliver to the tenant that basically says, you have X days to stop this or you'll be evicted. This usually gets their attention. Next, you can't solve everything. With many issues, I just tell the tenant, sorry, there's nothing I can do. For example, if a tenant complains about another tenant walking too loudly across the floor, I can't tell the upstairs tenant to tiptoe around their unit. And last, fire a tenant. If one tenant is constantly causing problems, fire them. Ask them to move, pay them to move, or when their rental lease comes up, simply let them know that you'll not be renewing their lease. So they'll need to move. About 10% of your tenants will cause 90% of the drama, so don't hang on to that 10%. Fire them and move on. Number three, moving in unapproved pets or people. This happens more often than you think. Tenant Gary moves in his girlfriend, Rhonda. Rhonda moves in her cat, Baxter. But neither Rhonda nor Baxter were approved to live in the property. So what do you do? When a tenant moves a person into their unit, the new person must be approved by you, the landlord. In other words, they need to fill out an application, pay the screening fee, and go through the same process as any new tenant. Otherwise, you'll have no idea who is living in your property. How would you like to find out you are renting to a level 3 sex offender? Now that's bad for business. If you notice that a tenant has moved someone into the unit without telling you first, you must address this promptly. Send a letter that states the problem and give them a short time frame in which to fix it. Include an application and insist that it is filled out. If the tenant ignores you, post a legal notice to comply in accordance with your state's law and evict them if they don't. Again, this is all about training your tenant. As for pets, this can be hard if you are an animal lover like I am, but you must make the tenant abide by the contract they signed with you. If pets are allowed on the property, make sure the tenant pays the required fee if you have one and that the pet is licensed. If pets are not allowed, send a notice to comply form and give them a short deadline by which to remove the animal. You are not being cold and heartless. You are simply protecting your investment. Since we're on the topic of pets, why don't we talk about that? I absolutely love my two dogs and my two cats. I'm a total animal person and I couldn't imagine life without them. However, although pets can be a man's best friend, they are definitely not always a landlord's best friend. Pets cause additional wear and tear on a building, make noise that irritate the neighbors, and can bite people, which can trigger a lawsuit. If not taken care of properly, pets can also cause a property to smell bad and can chew up pieces of building material not meant for consumption. So, should you accept pets? For me, the answer is generally no. However, there are times when I will accept them and the logic may seem a bit backwards. The nicer the property, the greater chance I'll allow a pet. In my experience, dirty people have dirty pets, but clean people tend to have clean pets. In general, nicer properties attract nicer tenants who take better care of their pets. Ironically, as I was typing the previous paragraph this morning, my dog jumped off the couch and proceeded to throw up all over the floor. Seriously. So I set down my laptop, carefully cleaned up the mess, and came back to my writing. No smell, no stain, no problem. However, had that happened with a dirty tenant, I would expect to find the remains of that puke when the tenant moved out. I don't know how people live that way, but trust me, they do. I never allow pets in a multifamily property, period. Although I might like tenant A and I could allow them to get a cat, which likely wouldn't be a problem, tenant B is going to see that I allowed a pet and they're going to move in a big, angry German shepherd. Then I'd have to be the jerk who makes them get rid of their dog and must try to explain why I allowed the other tenant to have a pet but not them. If the home is a nice single-family home, I may allow a pet under a few conditions. One, the tenants are high-quality tenants. I've seen their car. I've seen their previous house. They have great references. Two, I usually set a 20-pound limit for dogs to keep out the big, dangerous breeds. Three, if finding a non-pet tenant is difficult. If I have a number of vacancies, I may allow a pet in a single-family house to help fill the vacancy faster. Stable people tend to have pets, and I want stable people, so I might trade the risk of a pet in order to get a house filled quicker. As an added bonus, good, stable tenants tend to have pets, and they have a hard time finding rentals that will take them. Therefore, those tenants do tend to stay longer. Number four, I always charge a non-refundable pet fee when the tenant moves in. Right now, that fee is $300 per pet. This may seem steep, but trust me, animal people will pay it. I might give a slight discount if it's two cats or a small dog or a small cat, like $300 total, but I always charge the fee. Make sure to check with your state's laws as to whether or not you can charge a non-refundable fee for this. If not, just add it to the security deposit. Number five, the pet must be licensed with the city and currently on all its shots, and the tenant must sign my pet addendum. I wish pets could live in all my properties. They're so cute and innocent, but the problem is not with the pets, it's with the pet owner. Left unchecked and uncared for, pets can cause immense damage to your property and rob cash flow from your pocket every year. So think long and hard before allowing a pet in your rental, and if you allow it, take the precautions necessary to ensure you don't get screwed at the end of the tenancy. Of course, when I'm talking about pets, I'm not talking about renting to people with service animals. Service animals are protected by federal law, and a tenant with a service animal cannot be denied the ability to have that animal, or you could face some serious discrimination charges. Number four, breaking a lease. Let's just say that a tenant had signed a one-year lease with you, but in the seventh month, they find a new place and they ask to leave. What should you do? Well, stick to the lease. The lease is a legal contract between you and your tenant, which is something you must remind your tenant. Tell them that it's fine if they move, but they must continue paying rent until their lease is done or until you get the unit re-rented to another person. Let them know that you'll do your best to get the property rented to another family, but you can't guarantee how long that will take. Of course, you probably will not end up taking a tenant to small claims court if they do break their lease. They'll probably just keep their security deposit and take the loss. But you don't need to let them know that. Number five, drugs. Drugs are never fun to deal with, but this is a situation you likely will encounter as a landlord, no matter what class of tenant you rent to. The fact is this, some of your tenants will likely do drugs. Most of the time, you'll never know it until it's too late and they begin using their rent money for drugs and coming up with all sorts of excuses as to why the rent is late. Stick to your policy and follow the steps we talked about earlier. If you suspect drug dealing in your property, this is usually obvious because of the heavy traffic your tenant receives, usually from people who stay just for a minute or two. You have a few choices. You could evict them and try to get them out of the property, but you run into the challenge of having to convince a judge that they are dealing. If the judge decides to be lenient and give the tenant one more chance, you might waste a lot of time and money for nothing. Instead, I followed the same steps I outlined earlier when the tenant doesn't pay rent. First, I ask them to leave or simply don't renew their lease if they are at the end of their term or if they're paying month to month. If I can't simply ask them to leave, I'll pay them to leave. I'm not going to confront them on my suspicions of drug dealing. I'm simply going to let them know I'm doing some restructuring and need them to move out promptly. If they still won't move out, I could wait until their lease is up or go the eviction route. If you find yourself in that situation, no matter what you do, don't let them stay long. A drug dealer can cause you to lose good tenants and put a serious delay on your ability to build wealth. And of course, there's always cash for keys, where you could pay the tenant to move out. For a drug dealing ruffian, this might just do the trick. If you are unhappy, your system is broken. Hopefully by now, you've picked up on the fact that systems are incredibly important to me. I'm a huge believer in running your rental business as a business, which means having processes, checklists, and ways of doing things that are repeatable and explainable. When the tenant pays rent late, I have a defined process for dealing with the problem because I have a system in place for it. When a tenant wants to move in a dog, I likewise have a process for handling that request. Then, when I want to buy a new rental property, I have a process. Systems and processes make business easy and fun. A good system allows you to work less and enjoy life more. Of course, Not everything you encounter can be planned for ahead of time. For example, I recently had a tenant call and tell me, "Hey, Brandon, I just saw another tenant in the apartment complex sitting in his bedroom window, pointing a shotgun out the window." I don't have a specific process or checklist for that, so that was a problem I had to deal with on the fly. Problems cause stress, stress causes chaos, and chaos causes unhappiness. I don't want to be unhappy, and I'm sure you don't either. So I want to explain something that will revolutionize your life. If you are unhappy, your system is broken. In other words, if something in your business is causing you stress, most likely you either don't have a system for that issue or you are not following your system. Either way, it is broken. I don't get stressed anymore when tenants pay rent late because I have a system. However, recently I did discover a system I've not yet perfected, finding contractors. I was recently rehabbing a home that I plan to rent out. Although I've been using several different contractors on the project, as the property neared completion, my contractors stopped showing up. The tenant had already paid the first month's rent and was ready to move in, but the house was not done. I called every contractor I could, but no one would show up. I ended up picking up my tools, heading to the house, and I finished the job alongside my wife. The whole time, I was stressed and irritated, thinking, I should be working on my book right now, or I should be finding another great rental property deal right now. Instead, I was doing hard physical labor and I didn't really want to do it. That is when it occurred to me, my system was broke. Rather than be mad, I changed my attitude to, okay, how do I fix the system so it never happens again? How do I make this process easier and more reliable next time? I brainstormed about a half dozen solutions and began writing down my new system for making sure contractors finish a job, including making sure paydays were given only after certain benchmarks were achieved, thereby incentivizing the contractor to finish if they want to get paid. Next time, I'll also likely hire a project manager to handle the contractor relations, something I recognize as a weakness of mine. Will this work for me? I don't know, but next time I have a large rehab on a rental property, I'm going to try it out and test it on the new system. And I'll continue to tweak it and test it until the rehab process on a large property is as smooth and easy as dealing with a tenant paying their rent late. As you build your investment business, problems are going to occur. Like the trees I described at the beginning of this chapter, the strongest trees grew from being shaken. So don't think of problems as irritations, but as opportunities to strengthen your system. And the stronger your system, the greater your ability will be to scale and the less work you'll need to do to build wealth. Stop being unhappy, stressed, and surrounded by chaos. Systematize everything and find peace in your business. I could have concluded this book here, but managing your properties is not the end of the game. Someday, you'll need to do something with your rental properties. So in the next chapter, I'm going to focus on the end goal and everyone's favorite part, building serious wealth. Chapter 19, Exit Strategies and 1031 Exchanges. Mitch Hedberg, comedian, once said, "I was at this casino minding my own business and this guy came up to me and said, 'You're going to have to move. You're blocking a fire exit.' As though if there was a fire, I wasn't going to run. If you're flammable and have legs, you are never blocking a fire exit." Widely considered one of the most influential military leaders in human history, Alexander the Great began his conquest of the Middle East at the age of 20, and a decade later, he controlled one of the largest empires the world had ever seen. But then it all fell apart because of poor long-term planning. At the age of 33, the Great King was struck by a severe fever and died. Because he had not appointed an heir to take over his vast empire, the Macedonian kingdom fell into a 40-year civil war. Although I don't expect civil war to erupt in your life because of bad planning, the truth is the same. Poor long-term planning results in chaos. In this chapter, I will help you to peer into the future and look at the possible choices you have for relinquishing your throne, so to best prepare for the day that you do. After all, chances are that you don't want to hang on to your properties forever. Maybe you do. But this book is primarily focused on buying the asset that will take you into retirement, hopefully at an early age. But the fact is that you didn't get into real estate to own a bunch of rentals. You got into real estate for the benefits that those rentals can provide, namely financial freedom, wealth, and security for you and your family. As a result, sometimes you'll need to get rid of properties to either trade up to a larger deal or trade down to fewer properties, or simply to ride the wave of buy low, sell high. So let's talk about some of the best exit strategies for your rental portfolio. Hold forever. Speaking about stocks, billionaire Warren Buffett once said, "Our favorite holding period is forever." Personally, I don't think this is a terrible strategy for real estate investors either. It is entirely possible to hold onto your properties forever. Perhaps your kids will inherit the property after you go, or perhaps the property will be sold upon your death and the money distributed among your family. Although there is nothing wrong with this plan, I do encourage